Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And it happens to be Feedback Friday. And actually, the reality, what we're really going to be doing today is kind of diving into the 14th Amendment after we kind of cover a couple of things. And I hope to get to it. If not, we're going to dive straight into the 14th Amendment on Monday. Now, before I do anything, as you know, it's now or never, right? But you also need to remember that when you're looking at the debt clock, that is fraud. And we're going to get into this when we cover the 16th Amendment. But just so you understand, the federal government doesn't have the authority to do if they don't have the authority to engage in health care, in labor, welfare, or any of those types of things. And by the way, we're going through the ratification debates to prove that there was never any general powers granted for them to use the general welfare clause to just be able to do whatever they thought was a good idea. They were limited to the enumerations within the Constitution. If they wanted to do something different, like the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure, then they had to get the Constitution to be amended. That's why we cover the three presidential vetoes over the Department of Transportation. Just to be clear, what they're doing regarding environmental protection, regarding the CO2 pipeline, regarding some of the stuff that's in the news today, and we'll cover this, they have no authority to take out a loan to spend that money. And so let me just dive into, because I got hit with a few different things. And one of the things that kind of hit me was the responses from so many people regarding Trump's loss in court. Now, I'm not sure if that's, if that's going to be that big of an impact for you. But I do know this, that with these appeals and these convictions in these kangaroo courts, there's going to be states that are going to try to make the argument that he should not be listed on their ballot, right? Because, he's a criminal now, and, they're going to try to come up with these rules and so forth. Now, it doesn't bother me so much that he's lost. That doesn't bother me, because obviously that was a kangaroo court. That was not what we would call justice. But let me just say this. The one thing that really bothers me, because as long as I've known him in the political arena, when he spoke, when he talked about business and so forth, he wasn't such a narcissist. How's that? But when it comes down to, his whole political campaign, he just stands up there as the biggest narcissist I've ever seen. Now, like I said, that really doesn't bother me, because it shouldn't have that big of an appeal to people. So what really bothers me is how many people are appealed by that. What really concerns me is that there are more people fanatic about him than he is about him. I mean, you'd think that he was his number one fan. But folks, I'm telling you that there's way too many people in the United States that are elevating him to a spiritual prophet, a healer. They're elevating him way too high. And what really bothers me is some of these people that I know are Christian. And they, it's almost like we're at a point where, you know, I can easily, in the right venue, almost go fist to cuffs with somebody when I start talking bad about Ron Paul. And that's pretty pathetic when people look at, you know, that man who, you know, he may be a doctor and he may understand a lot of things, but he does not understand the Constitution, nor does he understand our history. And when he wrote, you know, audit the Fed, when he laid out that premise, audit the Fed, it spoke to his illiteracy regarding our Constitution. Now, I know I'm I'm hitting people right now square in the face, you know, right in the chin, nose, what have you. And because, I mean, you're taking offense because you've put him way too high on your, you know, your God pedestal. I mean, folks, are we worshiping men? Because that's what I see. Now, Ron Paul went out on record talking about America was not to be, to get intervened. We weren't supposed to be the policemen of the world. Actually, he's wrong. Because Thomas Jefferson proved we have a responsibility of ensuring that our commerce flies throughout the United States, throughout the world, over the seas, what have you, without being fettered and bothered. We have a right to be able to protect it, and we have a right to be out there ensuring that it flows freely. Now, the whole world has benefited from this, and we have been doing this as kind of like the police of the world. But what really should have happened is we should have been very clear that their commerce, your commerce, Sweden, your commerce, France, your commerce, Europe, your commerce, islands, wherever you are in the world, we don't care about your commerce. We're only out here protecting ours. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that those nations should have and would have been coming to our door saying, you know, would you mind adding us because it's just cheaper to use you out there and help fund you because that's a good thing, allowing commerce to flow. And as far as I'm concerned, I agree with that. If people want to help subsidize our efforts in securing the flow of our commerce as well as theirs, since we're there, then I think that would have been the right thing to do. But Ron Paul has convinced everybody else. He's almost like a sovereign citizen. It's almost like you put his face in libertarian and these I don't want to call them far left, but they are. They're out there because these people believe that we have a form of government that we don't have, and that has a lot to do with Ron Paul. And so Trump is the same thing. I see those people who look at Trump and they look at him as the opposite of Ron Paul. Ron Paul's kind of a pacifist, and Trump, he's not so passive. And so I think he appeals to a different side. And as a matter of fact, you know, because he actually says these things, we're going to make her walk. We're going to punish her for her crime. Right. But it's always come out as hyperbole. Right. It's just a hyperboil he's creating. Oh, well, you know, she's going to pay for this, pointing to Hillary. Well, how come she's not in the orange jumpsuit? How come Bill's not in the orange jumpsuit? How come Obama and the Bushes and all these other people who absolutely should be in orange jumpsuits and be tried have their day in court? But we don't see that. But this goes back to this other thing that I talked about last year when I was doing the presidential, a constitutional president's impact on America. You know, What could a constitutional president really do? There's no doubt in my mind we could turn this nation around so quickly if you had a leader who was leading on the Constitution. You're not going to get that with Trump. At least, I'm not seeing it. I am not seeing it. And so give me evidence. Give me evidence that he is absolutely getting closer to the truth and the real and the real basis of the Constitution and what the federal government can do. Show me that he's going to absolutely champion the states to step in and interpose, because that's who has to do it. If you're expecting the federal government to clean up the mess that they made, and then you got another thing coming, and you're getting it quickly, and you're getting it on a silver platter, and it will be your head, because they are coming for all of us. They're destroying this nation. They're waging warfare, and they've been doing it for decades and getting away with it. Did Trump shut down any of these warfare tactics? Did they stop chemtrails? Did they? He actually warp speed, put the vaccination on steroids, getting it developed and delivered. Folks, what really bothers me is there's way too many people that you know, you may be one of them, but I doubt it, but there's way too many people that you know, and you know I'm right. They look at him as a messiah. And this goes back to just last week, or maybe Monday. I forget when I said it, but I was telling you and talking to you about false prophets. And prophets have definitely hijacked our politics. These false prophets have, at least. So when we look at what's really going on, I mean, the fact that Manchin has left the Democratic Party is an indictment on the Republican Party and the two-party system. Is Manchin really a good guy? You know, you look at West Virginia, and West Virginia is very red. But he believes that he resonates better by not changing completely into the Republican Party. Interesting. In other words, the Republican Party is still not enough of a constitutional, conservative, whatever you want to call it. So that's why why else would he not go into the Republican Party? Why? Because they do not have the majority influence. There's still a lot of people. This is how a Democrat kept on winning in West Virginia. And he realizes he can't maintain his involvement in the Democratic Party. So he's obviously taken steps to change that. Now, there's a couple of things, and I kind of talked about Taiwan and everything else, and that has actually bore fruit. If you haven't heard, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, is going to meet his Chinese counterpart very soon. And this is kind of I don't even want to call it a big deal like the news media is calling it. I am here to tell you that what we're about to see between now and the election is Joe is going to have his midnight judge appointments, his midnight appointments. In other words, Joe is going to be doing things that are going to be so damaging to the United States because he can. And because he wants to make even a bigger mess, he wants to hurry up our demise. And he's going to do whatever he can, because right now, with Trump taking such dominations in the polls, that's very alarming. And this is one of the reasons why I believe we're going to see some states that are going to remove Trump from the ballot. Now, I'm okay with that, because Trump should never be on the ballot. Our president shouldn't be on the ballot. It should be our electors, those people who we want to vote for, to choose our president. That is how it's supposed to work. So, anyway, so what we're seeing is, with, I believe, this pandering to the Chinese and basically trying to reassure them that maybe they should make a move on Taiwan before the outcome of this election. That, you know, we're obviously going to fumble the ball, and we're going to be made fools out of. Now, Biden is also this week or next week is going to be signing this curbing of migration on the southern border. This is going to be an executive order. And basically, he wants to shut off the asylum requests and deny entrance to migrants with, and actually create daily thresholds if they're being exceeded. In other words, what he's doing is he's absolutely, this is an impeachable offense, folks. First off, he's using an executive order to create a law. And then secondly, he's not executing the law that is clearly in the Constitution, which he's obligated legally by oath of office to perform. His job is to repel the invasion. His job is to call Congress to say, give me the forces necessary to federalize the militia to repel this invasion. And he's not doing it. And to me, this is just another impeachable offense. And we're not going to see that because I'm telling you that the Republicans and the Uniparty wants these things to continue. There are a lot of people that are making bank off of this invasion. Those contractors that you know, all these people that are, you know, doing marginal work when they come and work at your house and so forth, they're making money because their salaries are being inflated because there's such a demand for housing. Same thing with plumbers. Same thing with electricians. All these specialists, well, hey, there's a demand. So they're off building new houses, getting time from them. This is why they're making almost lawyer salaries. Almost. As a matter of fact, I know guys that, you know, because they're in the profession, whether they're a plumber or what have you, they know that you'll be charged $100 and some odd an hour. So they'll come and do an odd job for you, but they're going to charge you the same. That right there are opportunists. And these guys, you know, they're so short-sighted. I can't wait till this all collapses because they're not doing anything. They're not actually realizing that they're a part of the problem. If you're a blue-collar worker where you've got a skill or what have you, and you're taking inflated wages and you're not doing anything about it because you know, because you're benefiting, and you know this is all wrong. We need to stop feeding the beast, allowing this invasion to occur, and all of these other things that the federal government is spending money on that it has no business to spend money on, whether it's, you know, alternate energy sources, whatever it is. If you're getting out there to try to get a little piece of the pie, you're a parasite that's a part of the problem. And I dare to think that anybody listening to this show is really a parasite. But we need to place context to what these people are doing. I want to be clear, folks, when we're looking at the problems that we're facing as a nation, we're just rewarding these people. These people are being rewarded for their bad behavior. So when we look at, you know, some of the things that Joe Biden is doing, if you didn't know, and again, this is just the crap I'm telling you, that he is going to bankrupt us. If he can, he's going to bankrupt us as fast as possible. He just gave away, or he's going to give away, $1 trillion in taxpayer funds from the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, this is money that is not accounted in the budget because I can't find it. And this is basically this huge gift that he's going to give to a pro-Palestinian left-wing organization that's called Climate Justice Alliance. And what these guys are, pro-Hamas, pro-Palestine. And he's going to give them this money so that they can go off and maybe do a part of the CO2 pipeline or some crap like that. Folks, do not expect Joe Biden to do anything good. And as a matter of fact, you need to put a light on all of these things, because this only proves what a scoundrel this man has done so many impeachable offenses that he should be tried, not only impeached, but he should be tried. He has been giving, he has failed to do his job in protecting America, our sovereignty, and the sovereignty of our states. I'll tell you what, constitutional illiteracy is killing us. It literally is killing us. One of the things that, because of the invasion on the southern border, right? And as a matter of fact, there's this new movie called Border Wars. And I haven't gotten the movie yet. I'm supposed to get the movie so I can watch it, so I can have an interview with one of the people involved in that. And I'm looking at what the heck's going on. And as a matter of fact, in Denver, this, we've talked about the housing crisis. We talked about the crime and everything else. In Denver, they're launching a drone called First Responder. It's a drone system that they're setting up. And this is going to basically do their 911 calls, because they're taking all of the money that they're getting and for this invasion, for putting up these invaders. In other words, what they're doing is basically, because they become a sanctuary city, they're committed, because the strings attached to the money that they get, they actually can't use that for the police. So they're creating a drone system that is actually going to go out and look at and try to do an assessment. Do we really need to dispatch police? In other words, their job now is to say, yeah, but it's not worth it. We're not going to go. Folks, what is happening in Denver, and this is going to be happening everywhere else, where they are basically trying to destroy your city. You as the people need to demand for constitutional carry, and the militia needs to arise from this. In other words, you need to demand your sheriff actually start developing the militia. You need to demand that the people, all people, are armed. Because you want to cut back crime, because what the police, what this mercenary force system in Denver is telling you is that they don't care about your life. They've gotten successful in disarming you, and now your life, it's not even negotiable. They are not going to be there for you. Bottom line, the two objects of government is to protect life and to protect private property. And if they aren't doing that at all, and what they're doing is they're protecting the invaders, then your government is not serving you. And what you need to do about it, folks, you already know, but I'm going to tell you again, because I have to tell you again and again and again. You have to start using First Amendment petitions to stop the invasion. As a matter of fact, we have a petition. It's Petition 3, Reclaiming the Republic. Go to the petition page, download Petition 3. It's about stopping the invasion. And you can use that, and you can just add to it that every person that is a public servant in Denver who has not taken a stand against what Denver is deciding to do, every single one of them's got to go. You have to start. See, folks, you got to start taking a stand. And as a matter of fact, I think that the sentiments in America are going to swing. And this is what really scares me. Because when they swing back and forth, they swing back and forth to extremes. We're seeing the extreme swing into the left, where life and property is, you know, no longer valued. The agenda is valued, getting more and more. What do we call it? Militants. We'll be getting more and more combatants into America to fight you. And nobody wants to state the obvious. This has been calculated. This is being managed and led by what we call our public servants, or our federal government. Federal government is leading the way. They're basically recruiting in Central America, Latin America, what have you. And they know the Chinese and all sorts of other threats are coming in. And the bad threats really do bypass, because I think that they're communicating where to go. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's get into the 14th Amendment with Kurt Lash, but actually, I'm going to pull the tablecloth off and watch how many things stay on. I was asked, and I've been asked, actually I've been pulled into a few different conversations, and many of the times, or on a very specific issue, but many of the times these issues are being driven by secular, godless people who are either in the conservative movement or they're outright liberal. So you got to consider the source. You got to understand that when people are making arguments against the 14th Amendment, or more importantly, against our founding principles, then you literally have somebody that is trying to create disinformation. Now, the recent argument that I've been dragged into, and I was just recently asked if I would come on to Angeline's show to talk about this, because I just got an email today. And so I'm going to come on to her show. But I was also in a couple conversations outright in person. And I was in social media where somebody actually, you know, attacked a person that basically was talking about America as a Christian nation. Now, John Adams, to be clear, John Adams was the one that said to the king of the Ottoman Empire, that America was not a Christian nation. Now, John Adams is, well, let me just say this. He is a man that was steeped in his biases. He looked at most of the other religions of the states in the Union as heathens. He was a Puritan. He believed that they had the true church and that the rest of the United States was not. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's almost like it's, you know, I don't know, it's not 2-0, 3-0, 4-0. We're probably on 10-0. Right, the 10th version of American division of Christianity. And I know that there's lots of people out there that will point to all of these different, and whether they like it or not, these are all equally devised. They're based on Christ and the Bible, whether it's the Mormons, the Jehovah Witnesses, right? I mean, you may not like their doctrine, but you can't say that they're not Christian. Well, you can. And I think you'd be denying. And as a matter of fact, I know one thing. This just resonates in my heart. That Christ does not take kindly when we take hatred towards other people who are trying to believe in him, whether they're misgiven or not. As a matter of fact, when we actually are judging and hating people because of how they worship Christ, I don't think you could put on heavier, more condensed concrete boots and then take a swim. because you're just going to sink. There's nothing that's holding you up with, I will just say, righteousness. You're not in the righteous position when you're actually saying that those people are righteous. Now, I will go on to say, I have seen several times where I've seen organizations destroyed because of Christian doctrine. And so what we look at with John Adams is almost the same as the way the evangelicals hate Mormons. And if you understand, regardless of where you are on your feeling of Mormons, if you happen to feel that or if you know, the research has actually been proven in 2012. This is why we're so divided, not just on Mormons, it's Catholics too, right? The evangelicals will not vote for a president if they're Mormon. I don't even think they'll vote for a president if they're Catholic. And so, and anything else, you have to be evangelical, Protestant, or what have you. Now, folks, all I'm basically doing here is pointing to the fact that we are still over-divided, and I'm telling you that we're nowhere close to where the framers were. John Adams was a unique man because he had a very sharp tongue, he had a very sharp attitude, but he at least put aside his differences and worked with the heathen Anglicans, and worked with the Congregationalists, and worked with all of these other different variants of Christianity. The point is this, that even though he said we weren't a Christian nation, I ask you this. How is it that a nation of 13 states, 13, 100% of those states, all of them had a church, or I should say, a state-sponsored church, and each of those churches was Christian in foundation. So, when we look at the facts, and I could go through each of the states, and I could give you what their denomination was, and you will see that there was not truly a dominant state. And when I say that, we could probably say that the Anglican Church was the most dominant. But that would have actually created such rifts with the Puritans and other states, small states, but enough to actually create such a rift with those states that had they tried to form a federal government with a direct relationship to the Anglican Church, they would have failed. They knew that the only way that they could succeed was not by creating a godless nation, but creating a nation that respected all of Christianity and the Christian states that were in the nation. As a matter of fact, when they started opening up new states, when they started admitting new states, they wanted to make sure that the states that were coming in, one, spoke English. The majority of the people spoke English. In other words, they knew that there was a possibility of Spaniards and or Catholics coming into America. And Congress actually laid down, no, they have to be Christian. So they actually started creating parameters for states to come in that they had to have so of 60% or whatever the percentage was, a threshold of Christians, not Catholics. So, excuse me. So what we actually see is that they did things that was actually very, if you want to call it protective or defensive. They made sure that they, kind of kept certain religions out. And over time, Catholicism became quasi-acceptable. And as a matter of fact, the irony is that Catholicism actually kind of got a good foothold in Massachusetts, in the land of the Puritans. Because the Irish settlers that went in there brought their Catholicism with them. And so when we look at the religious strife, the religious, I'll just say, oppression in America, it was very evident, very, very evident, that if you were openly Jewish, you could not practice, and most states did not allow Jews to openly practice in America. They were banned. The same thing with Islam. Same thing with, you know, Hare Krishna, Confucian, all of these different ideologies around the world were not allowed to migrate to America to establish or to openly practice. You could come, but you were not able to actually openly practice or even a proselyte. In other words, try to do missionary work to convert people. In other words, there were these protections of Christianity. Not only that, so as I lay down this argument, and then I'll get into Lash, the fact is that you had to not only be Christian to get respect, you could not have your day in court if you weren't a Christian in good standing. Because if you were not Christian, you were atheist or something else, and you weren't in good standing with your church, you could not bear witness in a court, because at that point in time, you were questioned whether you could be trusted. They didn't just, you know, when you walked into court, it wasn't just assumed that we trusted every person. The sheriff would actually go and check, you know, hey, this person lives in this community, does he? And this is the church that serves that community. You know, what do you know about this guy? Well, he's not in good standing here. We don't even know who he is. Ah. And there were cases, and this isn't just an aberration. There were plenty of cases. I think in Alexis de Tocqueville, he points out two cases. He points out one that just shocked him, and then he actually pointed out another one that actually supported it. That if you were an atheist or if you were not a Christian in good standing, this was in the 1830s, folks. Right? 1830s, 50 years past the Revolution, right? So we're looking 50 years past the Constitution, practically. So when we're looking at, you know, these precedents, you had to be Christian in good standing before you would actually get the opportunity to testify, to take a case to court. As a matter of fact, it probably, one of the things that probably forced the acceptance of, you know, atheists and these other people is because probably Christians behaved badly, taking advantage, knowing that nobody could get justice unless you were Christian in good standing. So you could be a bad Christian in good standing, in other words, lying and deceiving non-Christians, and that became tolerable until the justice system said, no, we're going to be more tolerant, because we're seeing this abuse. That's what ends up happening. Every time people are empowered, they take abuses. Look at what happened. Looks what happened with the transgender society, or these groups that are deviant sexually. Now that they have been tolerated, now they're spitting in your eye and they're poking you. This only proves that when a person obtains that normalcy or this acceptance from tolerance, they actually start using, they become intolerant towards you. And they start using that as a weapon. And as anti-Christian became tolerated in America, well, are you surprised? Are you surprised that it actually became intolerant towards Christianity, where if we've actually got a nation that has become anti-Christian? The Antichrist Church was established by the federal government. I'm not kidding, folks. I am not kidding. So back to this whole, this amalgamation of this nation, clearly we were a Christian nation. We were. We actually clanged to and developed, but the problem was, I think so many people, they because of the way they abused and the way we applied this, we started losing our Christianity, our are not, and it's not about tolerance. It's about, you know, turning the other cheek, being Christ-like. But my point is this, folks, that let nobody tell you otherwise that this was a Christian nation as a republic. The real difference was that when the federal government was forming, they all realized, these men that were called the framers and those who went to the ratification debates were very understanding of how intolerant these states would become if the federal government created an alignment, because it was normal business to create an alignment. And as a matter of fact, they realized with the theocracy of the British monarchs, the way they imposed their theocracy, the way they wrote their own Bible, they were really, really weary of being able to do that in America. And the whole point was that they were to make no law respecting a religion, nor establish a religion at the national level. And all this time, as they started going secular, that's exactly what they were doing. They were creating a godless nation, and they were demanding the godlessness was the doctrine preached by all, that everybody receive this new gospel of godlessness. And it was taught into the school systems. And this is why I've clearly pointed out that even though you may be sending your children to Sunday school, they are sending your children to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday school, where they're learning absolute conflicting doctrine with what you're trying to teach them. Literally learning conflicting doctrine to where kids are coming out of school and they are nowhere towards the assemblance of the culture and the family that they grew up in, folks. So you can't tell me that we weren't that way. We weren't Christian in the very beginning. And by the way, the bottom line is this. What year was the Constitution signed? Well, we know it was signed in 1788. 1788 was the year that they signed it. They created the federal government in 1789. But the real year was in the year of their Lord, because that is clearly mentioned right there in the Constitution, that it was done in the year of their Lord. Now, they didn't use those types of titles other than the divine hand of providence. They used Lord and those things. But anybody that thinks that they weren't Christian, then you got to look at the very first Thanksgiving proclamation by George Washington. Now, a lot of people call George Washington a heathen and not Christian, a Mason and so forth. And I'm here to tell you that he was a righteous man. He may not have been, you know, the most intelligent, but he did understand the divine hand of providence and his impact in his life in fighting the Revolutionary War and all of these other things. And he recognized the need to call the nation to service for one day of fasting and service to the Lord who gave us this beautiful nation. Now, let me dive into Kurt Lash's commentaries or his account of the ratification. Now, he mentioned the comity clause, and I just talked about the comity clause last time. When we look at the point of the comity clause, which is basically this, the comity clause is the privileges and immunities clause, which prevents a state from treating citizens of other states in a discriminatory manner. This basically created this concept of reciprocity. However, the federal government did not have the power to actually get involved in determining, because some states were very different. If you, in one state, had the ability to proselyte and, you know, preach your religion door to door, you go up to Massachusetts, you couldn't do that. Okay, so there were certain things that the federal government was just very limited on. Because with the Bill of Rights, they couldn't even make a law regarding that. So this is what he said. Now, this is back to Kurt Lash and what he read. Despite the defeat of my policy, he's talking about President Andrew Johnson, had one final act to play in the drama of the 14th Amendment. With ratification at an impasse due to the Southern state policy of masterly inactivity, President Johnson met with the conservative advisors and drafted an alternate amendment that he hoped would attract the support of Northern and Southern conservatives. Unlike the proposed 14th Amendment, and this is again in 1866, which declared that no state shall, quote unquote, no state shall henceforth violate the rights of citizens of the United States, Johnson's alternate version erased the proposal of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So when you look at what was very special about the 14th Amendment, when you look at what Andrew Johnson was actually trying to propose as a Southerner who was basically saying that the blacks were being fairly treated, and we already kind of covered this terrible, you know, massacre. We've already kind of talked about that, how he just basically put that off. And so he basically did this. He says, no state shall henceforth violate the rights of the citizens of the United States. Johnson's alternate version erased that privilege and immunities and replaced it with a passive reaffirmation of the comity clause. Instead of requiring states to enforce substantial rights like speech, assembly, and so forth, he basically wanted to require that the states would provide equal access to a limited set of conferred rights. The proposal went nowhere, and Congress proceeded to pass a series of legislative acts that ultimately secured the ratification of the 14th Amendment. The 1866 national political struggle between Johnson and the congressional Republicans opens a historical window on the original meaning and public understanding of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. By making the proposed amendment the focus and dispute between the contending political parties, Johnson triggered a sustained national public debate regarding the nature and the importance of the Privileges and Immunity Clause of the United States. The events of the summer of 1866 further deepened the national debate on focusing on the particular enumerated rights of speech and assembly rights that were widely accepted examples of the privileges, privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Excuse me. Johnson's final effort to replace the language of the Privileges and Immunities Clause with the language of the Comity Clause illustrates his understanding that the amendment as proposed was both different from and more expansive than the Comity Clause. This cuts equally against two recent lines of scholarship, one viewing the Privileges or Immunities Clause as providing nothing more than a degree of equal protection for conferred rights. Now, actually, if you read through further, there is the equal protection under the law. Why would they say that the preceding line of no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities, how is that just basically this what they're calling this equal protection? No. The equal protection is its own line, making it impossible for a state to make or enforce a law that abridges privileges and immunities is far more active, far more positive law in keeping the states from being able to do it. Now, that's me adding that. Back to Lash's words. The third in a series of works on the Origins and Privileges of Immunities Clause, this article focuses on the public consideration of the 14th Amendment. Two previous articles considered the antebellum understanding of like phrases like privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States and the drafting debate of the 39th Congress. All three aspects, pre-amendment, legal understanding, framers' understanding, and contemporaries' public understanding, are critical components of comprehensive view of the original meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Together, they mutually reinforce a conclusion that the phrase privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States refer to the personal rights enumerated in the federal Constitution. That includes, my friends, the Bill of Rights. These rights included the substantiated personal rights listed in the first eight amendments, as well as the equal rights of sojourning citizens protected under the Comity Clause of Article 4. So in other words, the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause clearly added those protections from the federal government now applied to the states, that states could not take away your right to assemble. States cannot take away your right to religious worship and your conscience, your speech. They cannot take away your right from being protected from unreasonable search and seizure, that you have a right and a and what we basically call the 14th Amendment right, right? When we actually look at, not the 14th Amendment. What's wrong with me? When we actually look at the different protections that are in the Constitution, and we look at how important it is to actually look at, you know, something like the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers. So it says persons. It leads with persons. You're walking along down the street, and there are camera systems that are tracking you, monitoring where you're going and what you're doing. That right there, by the state being able to do that, right there is a violation to being secure in your person. They cannot just monitor. The fact that they're using, it's one thing to actually have like a crowd view to see that there's a crime occurring, not who's doing the crime, where you were going, because with facial recognition, they're monitoring you. The system is monitoring every person and keeping track of what you do, what store you go into, how long you were there, all of that, because it's just like a vacuum collecting data. Folks, your rights are being violated. And with the fact that states are passing these types of laws that are allowing this monitoring, these monitoring systems with facial recognition technology, that directly violates your constitutional rights. It's the same thing with saying you can't go to work. You can't conduct commerce because because there is a pandemic, a declared pandemic, or a flu, or a high concentration of people being sick. It doesn't matter. They can't take away your rights. No state shall make it. So if you want to go commit and actually partake in commerce or religious expression, or even, you know, going out and assembling with other good people, they cannot make a law that takes that away from you. Not even if they declare martial law. They have to deploy the militia. Go read what is the real problem. It is on the Constitutional Articles page, and you'll understand the parameters required with martial law. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.